Chapter 9. Troubleshooting. How are you doing with your new way of eating? Are you reaching your weight loss goals? Are your glucose and A1C coming down? Is your cholesterol improving? If you are having any sort of trouble, this chapter will guide you through the most common problem spots. Not losing weight. People who begin low-fat vegan diets typically lose weight easily. In our research studies, the average rate is about 1 pound per week. Some lose more quickly, others a bit more slowly, but a pound a week is a good pace. If you think about what this means over a year's time, the result is impressive, particularly since you are free of the yo-yo syndrome that comes with diets based on calorie restrictions. Because this is not a short-term starve-yourself-thin diet, it does not cause hunger, so there is no rebound binging. Gradually, healthy weight loss is what you can expect. Sometimes losing weight can be a bit like following the stock market. There are fluctuations up and down, but the trend should be clear. If you are not losing weight, it is time to take action. Here are the steps to take. Get back to the basics. Be sure you are following the guidelines in Chapter 4 and giving it 100%. That means no animal products in your diet at all. If your diet includes fish or cheese, for example, your weight loss efforts will be hampered. Check for hidden oils. Packaged foods should include no more than 2 to 3 grams of fat per serving. If you frequently eat at restaurants, try to assess to what extent they are packing oils into their meals. If you are unsure, or your server is unsure, ask for foods to be steamed rather than fried or sautéed, and that any sauces or dressings be served on the side. See Chapter 8. Do a quick fiber check. If you check your fiber intake and find that you are eating less than 40 grams of fiber per day, you'll want to bring in more beans, vegetables, and fruits. If your diet is vegan, low in fat, and high in fiber, it is very hard not to lose weight. Even so, here are a few things to consider. Simplify. It pays to choose simple foods rather than processed food products. The fewer ingredients, the better. One is ideal. Beans, broccoli, carrots, or brown rice, for example, do not need an ingredients list because what you see is exactly what you get. You know that no one has added any oil or processed away any fiber. Add more raw foods. Some people have had remarkable weight loss as a result of increasing their intake of raw foods. Chopped vegetables, salads, fresh fruit, these are all rich in fiber with no added fat and low GIs. Don't get sidetracked by rationalizations. Sometimes people who are not losing weight blame genetics, lack of exercise, or something else for their problem. Genetics and exercise do play roles, of course. But if you are not losing weight, the problem is nearly always dietary. Once en route from Washington to London, I was busily typing away on my laptop, writing an article about diet changes for weight loss. The passenger next to me happened to see what I was typing and took an interest in the topic. He had been overweight for several years and wanted to see what I might suggest. I explained our research findings about how diet changes could cause lasting weight loss. I pointed out that the key seemed to be changing the types of foods we eat. I launched into a discussion of the benefits of vegetables, fruits, beans, and whole grains, and the wonderful meals they can become. "That's interesting," he said, "but I think I just need to exercise more. That's my real problem. I used to exercise a lot, but lately I've been so busy." He brushed aside the whole topic of food. A few minutes later, the flight attendant came by with the meal service. She served him a ham and cheese sandwich, a bag of chips, and a soft drink, which he shoveled into his mouth without a word. I suspect he did not realize that it would take a very long session at the gym to burn away those unnecessary calories. The airline also served vegetarian meals, which would have been a much better choice. Shortly thereafter, I was talking to a patient with Stanley Talpers, M.D., an internist on the faculty of the George Washington University School of Medicine in Washington, D.C. The patient said he hadn't been losing weight and he figured that he just needed to walk more. Dr. Talpers encouraged him to get his diet in order first because, he said, To lose a pound by walking, you'd have to walk to Baltimore. It is true. Exercise is beneficial, and I strongly recommend it. But a lack of exercise is not the primary reason for weight problems, and exercise can never take the place of a healthful diet. Blood glucose not coming under control quickly enough. The primary way of tracking your glucose control is with hemoglobin A1C. As you know, the American Diabetes Association's goal is to have your A1C under 7%. Many clinicians now push for even lower goals, 6.5 or 6%. If you are not making good progress toward your goal, here are some points to consider. Get back to the basics again. If you are overweight, weight loss is the strongest predictor of a healthy drop in A1C. To jumpstart weight loss, review the tips we've just given you and those in Chapter 6. Whether you are overweight or not, those same points are also the keys to bringing your glucose under control. If your diet is vegan, it has no animal fat in it, of course. And if you are setting aside vegetable oils, it has very little of any kind of fat. With these healthy changes, you can just imagine those little bits of fat inside your muscle cells starting to shrivel up. As you heard in Chapter 2, these are the bits of fat that appear to be the cause of insulin resistance. Embrace healthy carbohydrates. Many people tie one arm behind their backs by avoiding starchy foods. They imagine that beans, lentils, pasta, sweet potatoes, or yams will push their blood glucose upward. And of course, if you check your blood glucose after just about any meal, it will be higher than it was before. However, don't let this turn you against starchy foods and back toward fatty or high-protein foods. Here is why. The fat in fish and chicken will tend to arrest your weight loss. It will also tend to aggravate your insulin resistance. Here is what happens in a typical case. A man has heard that carbs are bad, or perhaps notices that his blood glucose has gone up briefly after a meal of rice or starchy vegetables. He decides to avoid carbohydrates and adds fish and chicken back into his diet. At first, it seems like a good change. His blood glucose does not spike strongly after meals because there is very little starch in his meals to provide glucose. Aha, he says, I've found the diet to keep my blood sugar down. Over the next several days, however, he notices that his fasting blood glucose values are heading in the wrong direction. They go up bit by bit, and after a week or two, the rise is significant. Now what? He thinks. This is what is going on. There are only three sources of calories: carbohydrate, fat, and protein. In avoiding carbohydrate, he was left with fat, which tends to increase insulin resistance, and protein, which has problems of its own. The increased fat intake did not increase his blood glucose immediately, but fatty diets tend to increase the amount of fat inside the cells. The result is that insulin resistance gradually worsens. That means that any carbohydrate he ate later would cause a bigger blood sugar spike than it otherwise would have. As the days went by, his blood sugar gradually increased. The answer is to avoid fatty foods and choose healthy, carbohydrate-rich foods, letting the glycemic index help you choose the best of them. See Chapter 4. This means legumes, beans, peas, and lentils, vegetables, fruits, and whole grains. Meals will always cause a temporary rise in blood glucose. What you are looking for is an overall trend downward as your insulin sensitivity gradually improves. See your doctor. A very common reason for rising blood glucose levels is infection. A cold, a urinary tract infection, a foot sore, an ear infection, you name it. They all tend to raise your blood glucose. Sometimes a surprisingly small cut or a cough you're hardly aware of boosts your fasting blood sugar values. As the infection heals, with medical treatment as needed, your blood glucose will recover. Your doctor may decide to adjust your diabetes medications in the interim. Check your stress level. Stress raises blood sugar. The fight or flight response, The physical reaction that gets you ready to fight or run away from danger can kick in with any sort of threat, real or imagined. A rise in blood sugar was much more useful when the threats we encountered were predators and warring tribes. That extra blood sugar fueled the major muscle groups needed to run or fight. Today, we are more likely to be threatened by job worries, financial difficulties, or relationship problems, and rising blood sugar doesn't help during those times. But stress still evokes the response, and it still causes a blood sugar spike. If stress is temporary, you will see your glucose spike resolve quickly. If stress is ongoing, get help. Meditation, yoga, and other techniques can help you deal with stress. If the problem is deeper, if you are headed into depression or chronic anxiety, do not try to be a hero. See a qualified mental health professional and get started with a treatment that works for you. Exercise. If you are sedentary, now is the time to bring physical activity into your life. Vigorous exercise helps reduce blood glucose levels. See Chapter 11. In most cases, these steps will help bring your blood sugar down. If it remains high despite your best efforts, your doctor will want to adjust your medications. Persistent hunger. If you are cutting back on calories in an effort to lose weight, you may be left feeling hungry. One of the reasons I recommend a low-fat vegan diet is that it is so substantial. It provides plenty of fiber to fill you up and has no limits on portion sizes or calories. The result is weight loss without hunger. In our research studies, we use a questionnaire to measure hunger along the way, and we consistently find that this diet leaves people feeling satisfied. What if your meals don't quite hold you, though? Here are some suggestions. Starting with the obvious one, eat more. Maybe that little bowl of oatmeal is just not enough. When you are just getting to know new foods, it takes a little time to figure out the right serving sizes. You will soon sort this out. Go low GI and high fiber. If you have instant oatmeal for breakfast, you will get hungry sooner than if you have the old-fashioned variety. The difference is simply that instant oats have had their fiber sliced up. Instead of flat rolled oats, you have a box full of oat powder. That means that they cook quicker, but also that they digest quicker, spike your blood sugar quicker, that is, they have a higher GI, and leave you hungry quicker. Eating foods that are in as natural a state as possible prevents that overly rapid digestion and helps keep hunger at bay. You want foods that have both a low GI and high fiber content. A food that offers one doesn't necessarily have the other. For example, whole wheat bread has lots of fiber, but something about the wheat grain causes it to release its natural sugars into the bloodstream rather quickly. That is, it has a high GI. In fact, white bread, which has had its fiber removed, has virtually the same GI as whole wheat. In contrast, rye bread digests more slowly, releasing its natural sugars into the bloodstream more gradually, which means it has a low GI. To check your fiber intake, do a quick fiber check. Have healthy snacks. There will be many times when you will want to have a bite to eat between meals, and you should. See Chapter 5 for a discussion of the best choices. Quiet cravings. If you have had diabetes for any length of time, you have already been coping with the ubiquitous nature of junk food. Unhealthy snacks are everywhere. But why do they call to us as they do? Why is sugar or chocolate sometimes so attractive? Why is cheese or meat sometimes hard to resist? Where do cravings come from? One of our research participants once asked me what was wrong with her. She had had diabetes for 12 years. And even though she knew that she should stay away from sugary foods, she craved them, especially when she was stressed or tired. Cookies, chocolate, and pastries seemed to call her name. She had the cravings nearly every day. "I think I'm just a weak-willed person," she said. She was embarrassed about her cravings and found herself avoiding the subject when she spoke to her dietitian. Here is the most important thing to understand about cravings. They are not caused by weak will or gluttony. Cravings are triggered by biological properties of the foods themselves. That is, certain foods have chemical makeups that cause us to crave them in very much the same way that drugs, alcohol, and tobacco have addictive components. Let me be clear, only certain foods lend themselves to cravings. The same foods are alluring to almost everyone. Four types of foods trigger biochemical effects not unlike those of addictive drugs. They are not as strong or as dangerous as drugs, but the chemistry of addiction does seem to be at work with these foods. I have described these effects in detail in a book called Breaking the Food Seduction. Here, I will summarize the main points you need to know. The four categories of addictive foods are sugar, chocolate, cheese, and meat. Sugar. Sugar is not simply sweet. In addition to its taste, it also has a mild drug-like effect. That is, it affects the brain in essentially the same way as opiate drugs, morphine and heroin, for example, albeit not as strongly. This effect helps explain why people crave sugar, especially during times of stress. How do we know that sugar has this effect? In controlled studies, researchers use a medication called naloxone as a research tool. Naloxone is normally used in emergency rooms to block the effects of heroin or other opiates. If a person has overdosed on heroin, doctors inject naloxone, which blocks the heroin and any other narcotic from attaching to receptors in the brain. A comatose drug addict, previously on the verge of death, rapidly awakens with a dose of naloxone. Researchers have given naloxone to volunteers and offered them various sugary foods. They then measured how much the volunteers ate and compared the results to those of the same test done without naloxone. It turns out that naloxone causes a noticeable drop in sugar cravings. Normally, you might long for a glazed donut or piece of pie, but with a dose of naloxone, much of the attraction is gone. The effect is particularly clear for foods that contain both sugar and fat, cookies, cakes, and ice cream. Naloxone is given intravenously and is not a treatment for food addiction. It is a research tool. These experiments show that sugar does not simply delight the taste buds, it also stimulates the release of opiate chemicals in the brain. Just as intense exercise causes the release of endorphins, natural feel-good chemicals within the brain, sugar seems to do something very similar. Let me be clear about this. Sugar does not contain opiates. Rather, the taste of sugar on the tongue is what apparently triggers the release of opiates within the brain. In turn, these opiates trigger the release of another natural chemical called dopamine, which is the key to the brain's pleasure centers. Drugs of abuse, heroin, cocaine, marijuana, tobacco, alcohol, and all others, trigger dopamine release. Sugar appears to do the same. Evidence suggests that the effects of sugar on the brain ease pain and discomfort and give us a little boost. No wonder we turn to sugary foods, especially when we're stressed. Sugar has the same effects on infants just a few hours old. When babies are given a heel stick to draw a blood sample, they cry noticeably less if a bit of sugar water is dribbled into their mouth first. Sugar cravings go beyond plain sugar itself. Some people also crave foods such as white bread or bagels, which turn to sugar rapidly and release sugar into the bloodstream. In essence, they crave high GI foods, sugar, cookies, crackers, white bread, potatoes, or cold cereals. While we also enjoy low GI foods, we tend not to crave them. Chocolate. Chocolate's addictive qualities have long been recognized in psychiatric journals. In scientific studies, the most ardent chocoholic's desire falls away when they're treated with opiate-blocking drugs. These experiments show that it is not simply taste or mouthfeel that keeps us hooked. Chocolate also appears to have mild effects on our brains. Chocolate's attraction is not due simply to its sweetness. After all, no true chocolate lover would be satisfied with sugar alone. Chocolate also contains caffeine, theobromine, and phenylethylamine. These are all stimulants, and they may play a role in chocolate's seduction aside from its opiate effects. If you are a chocolate lover, you probably already know that chocolate is sometimes more than a food. You don't just feel you want it, you feel you need it. Regrettably, chocolate carries not only a load of sugar, but also a considerable load of fat. Cheese. Yes, it may smell a bit like old socks, but cheese is one of the foods that people who are trying to improve their diets have the most trouble leaving behind. There is obviously something besides fat and cholesterol in cheese that accounts for its popularity. That something may be the dairy protein or casein. Like all proteins, casein's molecular structure is very much like a long string of beads, with each bead being an amino acid. Normally, when proteins are digested, these amino acids come apart one by one and are absorbed into the bloodstream to be used to build body tissues and repair any damage to your body. Casein behaves differently. As it breaks apart, it does not simply release individual amino acids. It breaks into short strings of amino acids, strings of perhaps 4, 5, or 7 beads. They are not just the amino acid building blocks for protein, they are also biologically active compounds with a mild narcotic action. Scientists call them casomorphins, casein-derived morphine-like compounds. If scientists were to feed you cheese and then take a sample of your digestive tract contents, they would find an array of casomorphins with mild narcotic actions. Some have speculated that narcotic effects of casomorphins are responsible for cheese's attraction. These effects may also explain why cheese can be constipating, since narcotic compounds often slow digestion. Scientists are still trying to understand casomorphins. We know that they form in the digestive tract as casein breaks apart, and that they can pass into the bloodstream of nursing infants. They seem to act as mild sedatives for babies. We also know that casein is present in milk and ice cream and is especially concentrated in cheese. What we do not yet know is how extensively the casomorphins are absorbed into the bloodstream of adults. By now, you know if cheese is your thing. If so, its fat and cholesterol contents are conspiring against you. Shortly, we will look at how to kick this and other food addictions. Meat. Men, in particular, often describe meat as the very last food they would ever want to give up. No matter how often they are reminded of what it is doing to their waistline or cholesterol test results, many have trouble breaking their emotional attachment to roast beef, steak, or chicken wings. Once again, experiments with opiate-blocking drugs suggest that part of the desire for meat may have its basis in opiate effects within the brain. Researchers in England gave opiate-blocking drugs to volunteers and tested their desire for ham, salami, and tuna. The results showed that when the opiate effects were blocked, volunteers lost much of their interest in meat.